welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Tuesday, August 13, 2024. South Sudan's aviation authorities caution residents from living near airstrips.
My advice to the general public is to not build your houses or infrastructure closer to the airport so that such incidents is happening cannot be of harm to you.
And farmers in South Sudan's eastern Equatorial State say they are expecting good harvest.
Now we have a very big change to our community. For this small time, but preaching to the coming years, I think we can improve and get more yield than what we have been earning in our community.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil aviation authorities in South Sudan say there was no mechanical breakdowns in connections with two recent plane crashes in the country. A top civil aviation official says poor conditions of airstrips caused two planes to crash last week. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Three girls were killed in Jonglei State Thursday last week when a cargo aircraft chartered by the UN World Food Programme and operated by a commercial operator caught fire after landing at Piri Airstrip in South Sudan's Jonglei State. Another passenger plane, operated by United Nations Humanitarian Air Services, or UNHAS, crash-landed in Marakal Airport after its rear landing gears failed during takeoff from Maban Airstrip on Friday. David Subek Dada, Chief Executive Officer and Director for the South Sudan Civil Aviation Authority, says poorly maintained airstrips in Maban and Piri caused both planes to crash.
The infrastructure of the airport where the plane took off from, there was a dike built to prevent water entering into the airport. But during the takeoff, the plane hit the landing gears, or the plane hit the dike, and they broke off. That was why it has to land in Marakal on Delhi. Regarding Piri, also, it was during landing that I think the plane went off the runway and it went to some houses closer to the airport.
All passengers aboard the two planes survived the crashes. Subek strongly advises residents who live near airstrips to relocate to safer areas.
My advice to the general public is do not build your houses or infrastructure closer to the airport so that such incidents is happening cannot be of harm to you. Always be away from the airport. But people have got a temptation of coming very close in crossing the airport lane.
Kurkwal, director of Juba International Airport, says the ill-fated plane is owned by the South Sudanese company Nyasa with the Malawian registration number 7QSTB-5. Jonglei State Information Minister Nyamar Lunch says state officials are working with the World Food Programme to learn more about the fate of those who were killed and the two people who were injured.
The negotiations are ongoing for the compensation to the families that lost their girls, the daughters, and also for the people who their homes got burned. The government of Jonglei State has sent two ministers from the state government to the area, and we also have other delegates that also went from the national government.
Colonel John Kasara, the new spokesperson for the South Sudan National Police Service, says he just started working for the service and is not aware of steps being taken in the Piri plane crash to investigate the cause. In 2021, a cargo plane crashed in Juba, killing all five crew members on board. In 2020, a plane crash killed all 10 people on board in Piri. South Sudan aviation authorities say the high number of plane crashes is due to the use of old aircraft, lack of maintenance, and overloading. United Nations Humanitarian Air Services, or UNHAS, which operates 90% of flights for international non-profit in South Sudan, did not release details of the passenger plane that crash-landed at Malakal International Airport. Air transport remains the only means of travel for thousands of aid workers offering support to tens of thousands of vulnerable South Sudanese due to the lack of good road network and insecurity across some parts of the country. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Still on travels, travelers along the Juba-Mundri-Yambi Road say the removal of some illegal checkpoints allegedly erected by government troops has improved commute on the unpaved road. Matia Samuel Timetio reports from Yambio.
Salaba Dagbu is a trader in Yambio and he says traveling to and from Juba now takes less time after some illegal roadblocks along the Juba-Yambio road were removed.
We will have about 28 checkpoints, which was a challenge for us traders because wherever you move, you got a checkpoint and you cannot cross without paying in that checkpoint. But since Governor make an order, the checkpoint reduce a bit, not complete. We have current about 22 checkpoint out of 28.
Emmanuel Bangbe is the Secretary General for Western Equatoria State Chamber of Commerce. He says more needs to be done to ease travel for traders and commuters between Juba and Yambio.
What we're looking at is the number was very high. So the number has been reduced and I'm sure with time they will continue to see how best which ones can be removed and which ones can remain. It shows that the authorities are working together with the traders to ensure that this issue is resolved. We believe with time more is going to be done because we can see a start is already happening.
Benjamin Kamanda Gayos, Director General in the State Ministry of Local Government and Law Enforcement, says some of the checkpoints are for revenue collections and security purposes.
What I know is in Maridi County, Barahol and Mambe, those roadblocks are not there, removed. And then Mankakara, that is in Ibo County, but the rest remain intact. And even we used to discuss it in the Rule of Law Forum because it is a concern affecting almost every people, even humanitarian vehicles. Seeing the way forward is the state authorities have to discuss it in the security committee meeting such that at least they get a solution to this.
Earlier this year, Western Equatoria State Governor Alfred Futio Karaba directed the commissioners of Mundri County to remove illegal checkpoints, disrupting movements of trade, civilians, and aid agencies in the state. Along South Sudanese roads and rivers, state agents, security forces, as well as armed groups occupy checkpoints where they levy illegal taxes and hamper movement. Checkpoints are a major constraint to trade, economic development, and humanitarian access in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Matthias Samuel Timotheo, reporting from Yambio, Western Equatoria State.
UNICEF warns tens of thousands of Sudanese children may die over the coming month without immediate action because of what it calls a crisis of neglect. A representative in Khartoum reports 13 areas are on the brink of famine, causing malnutrition levels to soar. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Agency reports the extent of the horrors and atrocities inflicted upon children in Sudan is going unnoticed because it is not being reported. UNICEF says the crimes committed against children go unnoticed because aid agencies have very limited access to the country's hotspots. And it says the news that trickles out is not good. Speaking from the capital, Khartoum, UNICEF spokesman James Elder says he's spoken to people who have witnessed the suffering and violence to which children are being subjected.
Yesterday in Khartoum, I spoke to a senior medical worker who gave an insight into the magnitude of sexual violence during this war. She explained she has had direct contact with hundreds of women and girls, some as young as 8 years old, who have been raped. Many have been held captive for weeks on end.
He says thousands of children have been killed or injured in the war, while sexual violence and military recruitment are increasing. The International Organization for Migration reports heavy rains and flooding are creating new hardships for thousands of people already suffering from the ongoing conflict. Speaking from Port Sudan, IOM Sudan Chief of Mission Mohamed Refat says hunger has reached catastrophic levels on a scale not seen since the Darfur crisis in the early 2000s. UN agencies have said parts of the country are on the brink of famine.
Almost all people displaced across Sudan, 97%, are in areas with acute food insecurity or worse. In 3 months, an estimated 25.6 million people will face severe food insecurity as the conflict spreads and coping mechanisms are exhausted. 1 out of 2 are struggling to put food on the table every single day.
Refat says restrictions on humanitarian access are hampering the ability of aid agencies to save lives, particularly during the current rainy season. UN aid agencies say tens of thousands of preventable deaths will occur in the coming months without an immediate, massive, coordinated global response and the funds to mount a huge humanitarian operation. The aid official spoke as efforts continue to get U.S.-sponsored peace talks started in Geneva on Wednesday. On Monday, Tom Perriello, U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, told journalists that the paramilitary rapid support forces have committed to taking part in the talks if the rival Sudanese armed forces also take part. So far, the National Army has not agreed to participate. Perriello also said the U.S. has spent 4 weeks trying to negotiate an agreement for a local ceasefire that would allow humanitarian aid access. This first round of peace talks is expected to last up to 10 days. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Lack of agricultural skills, lack of access to markets, and conflict has disrupted farming in some parts of eastern Equatorial State's Magui County since 2020. But now some farmers say they are able to cultivate their farms after gaining skills from a non-profit. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa has more from the eastern Equatorial State capital, Taurit.
Many residents of Magui County are farmers who cultivate small plots of private land to make a living. Some say they are able to take care of their family's need after harvest. Lokang James Spen, a farmer from Lochari Boma in Obo Village, says training provided by the non-profit Save the Children gave him hope for good harvest.
Now we have a very big change to our community. For this small time, but preaching to the coming years, I think we can improve and get more yield than what we have been earning in our community. I'm a farmer. Most type of crop I'm producing here, maize, beans, sorghum, and cassava. The yields of maize for training, I'm seeing it is less. We can make locally. But now we get different practices like agronomic practice. Now we have seen the change.
Koma James Sylvester, a planner and food security analyst in the State Ministry of Environment and Forestry, says quite a few farmers have switched from subsistence to commercial farming. He says large-scale farming could reduce prices of goods in markets across South Sudan.
Support should be given to farmers who may be coming up, and those who have planned, those can easily come up. We encourage them. We need to support these private farmers, because even if they are few, these few farmers can do a lot to feed the people than remaining on just you produce for food. Subsistence agriculture cannot help us anymore. But we need to go bigger. When we have commercial agriculture, then they can produce a lot of food.
Moriko Gloria James, another farmer in Abara village of Magui County, says she gained knowledge on how to produce more food through crop planning.
The advantages of planting those seeds in lines, it helps those men also to weed the crops. The second advantage is it will be easy to manage the diseases who attacked the seeds.
A delegation from the Agricultural Bank of South Sudan visited Eastern Equatoria in June to assess the challenges facing farmers. State officials say the visit was aimed at providing loans and farm tools to progressive farmers across the state. Catherine Loyette Richard, another farmer in Adaba Lochari village, says what she learned in the training could help her in the practice of advanced farming methods.
We were not having that knowledge of good agronomic practices, but due to the 20 days or 1 month that we spent, we gained a lot of knowledge, and that knowledge we have started now imparting it to our community. And now I'm seeing other changes now on how to select the site or the land, and then the type of seed. We are kind of different methods that we can use in order for our farming system to improve.
Much of South Sudan population is engaged in subsistence farming. Many such farmers live in low rainfall savanna, growing sorghum and millet. Many South Sudanese households keep some livestock, particularly in rural areas. 75 farmers have benefited from skills they have gained regarding improved food production from agricultural partner with the nonprofit Save the Children, who trained farmers in Magwi County. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting in Torit, Eastern Equatorial State.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, immigration dominates election campaigns here in the United States. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The next time there is a census in the United States, in 2030, Americans who trace their ancestral roots to the Middle East and North Africa will have their own demographic category. MENA, VOA's Jania Dulut reports.
Here in California's Little Arabian neighborhood of Anaheim, activists were fighting for a new U.S. Census category, MENA, for Americans who trace their origin to the Middle East and North Africa for over three decades. Palestinian American Aya Shihade says having to check the box white on federal forms has made her feel invisible in American society.
I always didn't feel like I fit in the white box, and so I would always try to like check off any other box, either Asian or something else. Now it could finally feel like that we're seen and that it's okay to be Palestinian, it's okay to be Arab.
MENA includes nearly 30 different identities, says Arab American Civic Council Policy and Research Coordinator Amin Nash.
It includes Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, kind of the Arabian Peninsula, all the way till Palestine. And then from Africa, it'll go Egypt, and then all the way North Africa, so Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, all the way to Morocco.
Nash says it often depends on how people see themselves culturally. For example, Israelis who are included in MENA often identify as white because they trace their ancestry to Eastern Europe, whereas Armenians, he believes, should be included in the new category because they often immigrate to the U.S. from the Middle East. Arab American Civic Council Executive Director Rashad Al-Dabakh says the new census category will help Arab Americans better advocate for their needs.
Having our own separate community means that we can have numbers, we can have data. We know how many Middle Eastern North African folks live in our communities. For us as Arab American Civic Council, it's important when we mobilize people to vote, when we talk to our Congress member, we have data. We can tell them, look, Congress member, we have this many people that live in your district. We're a big community and you should listen to our needs.
Al-Dabakh says the change will make it easier for members of his community to apply for minority business loans, to track civil rights abuses, and to look at how different healthcare issues impact MENA members. Most people here in Anaheim's Little Arabian neighborhood welcome the change. Lebanese-American Tony Hakim does not. Visiting this bakery for traditional Lebanese flatbread, he says the change is more divisive than inclusive.
And what you really want, you want people to start thinking in terms of, I'm an American, I'm here. I don't want to go back to where I came from, because where I came from, I left behind. Now I'm looking forward. Looking forward to me is being in America and being part of the American culture and identifying myself as an American.
The new MENA category will be in place for the next U.S. Census in 2030. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, in the Little Arabian neighborhood of Anaheim, California.
Still on American affairs, critics of Vice President Kamala Harris have used her gender as a hit, saying both finally and clearly that a woman cannot hold the greatest powerful job in the free world. Gender scholars say those railing against Harris have also chosen another line of attack, her race. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Vice President Kamala Harris's quest for her nation's highest office has run headlong into a barrage of sexist attacks, hammering her love life, her clothing, and even her distinctive laugh. All classic hallmarks, experts say, of misogyny. Harris seeks to flip this narrative, which has persisted for more than a century since the first time an American woman ran for president. But scholars say Harris faces an additional challenge that she can't escape, her mixed race. Here's former President Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
This, scholars say, is a textbook case of misogynoir. Nadia Brown is professor of government and the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at Georgetown University.
Misogynoir is the horrible hybrid between sexism and racism that is specifically lobbed against Black women. And it's rooted in stereotypes about and against Black women, as well as them, these notions that they don't adhere to white heteropatriarchal supremacist norms.
These ad hominem attacks have prompted even some of Harris's harshest Republican critics to try to reel in the narrative. Republican Mike Johnson is Speaker of the House.
This is not personal with regard to Kamala Harris and her ethnicity or her gender. It had nothing to do with this whatsoever.
Scholars say there is a groundswell of support for women sticking to more traditional roles in society, as seen in the burgeoning Instagram-friendly tradwife movement, which sees women's roles as homemakers, mothers, and helpmeets. But some women voters dismiss these gendered attacks as ridiculous. Salinas Nash is a California voter.
That's the sexist people. That's all for men. That's all. They said that even when Miss Clinton was trying to run, they were like, oh, no, she's a woman. What if she have a period? She's going to start a war.
Georgetown University's Brown theorizes that Trump is using personal attacks because he fears meeting Harris face to face on the debate stage. In recent days, Harris and Trump have sparred on social media, accusing each other of dodging a debate planned for September 10th. Trump made the first move, calling instead for a September 4th debate, hosted by his favorite news network. Again, Nadia Brown.
I think that's probably a smart move on Trump's behalf, given that Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor, and what we've seen, everything we've seen about her and her debate performances leads many people to believe that she will mop the floor with Donald Trump.
Since women won the right to vote in 1920, their presence at presidential polls has risen. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Still on U.S. election issues, immigration is one of the top issues in the upcoming election. Vice President Kamala Harris is campaigning on her achievement as a prosecutor, while former President Donald Trump blasts the current administration's record and promises mass deportations. VOA's immigration reporter Aline Barros has more.
On the campaign trail, Vice President Kamala Harris highlights her background as a prosecutor, district attorney, and California attorney general.
I walked underground tunnels between the United States and Mexico on that border with law enforcement officers. I went after transnational gangs, drug cartels, and human traffickers that came into our country illegally. I prosecuted them in case after case, and I won.
While in office, former President Donald Trump built more than 80 kilometers of new border wall, reduced the annual cap on refugee admissions to historic lows, and enforced a policy that separated children from their parents.
This November, the American people are going to compare these records, and they're going to tell Border Czar Harris, you have done a horrible job. You're a disgrace to our country. You're fired. Get out of here. You're fired. Get out.
Immigration is a hot issue in this presidential election. A Chicago Council survey found that 50% of respondents say a large number of immigrants is a threat to the United States. Though just over half of Americans support a border wall and the use of American troops at the U.S.-Mexico border, most oppose mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. With Congress failing to pass immigration reform, the nation remains dependent on executive actions and regulations regardless of who is in office. Here's immigration lawyer Corey Foreman.
With the political environment we're in, it's a tough place because executive actions are always going to be the subjects of lawsuits, and we have a Congress that's not willing to act.
Harris pledges to support border security legislation, highlighting Trump's role in sinking a bipartisan Senate bill earlier this year.
He tanked the bipartisan deal because he thought it would help him win an election. Which goes to show Donald Trump does not care about border security. He only cares about himself. So here is my pledge to you. As president, I will bring back the border security bill that Donald Trump killed, and I will sign it into law.
Trump's Republican allies have urged him to focus on areas where they believe he has an advantage over Harris, especially on immigration. He continues to call for the deportation of undocumented migrants and criticizes the Biden-Harris administration for having what he calls an open border policy.
With your vote, inflation will stop. The illegal aliens will be turned back. They're not coming in. We got to stop them. Did you see where she's now saying, oh, we had a very good border. Oh, great. They had the worst border in the history of the world.
The U.S. Border Patrol logged about 130,000 migrant encounters in June, up from about 104,000 in the same month of 2019, Trump's last year before the pandemic, but down from the December 2023 peak of more than 300,000. Aline Barrows, VOA News, Washington.
And that's all we had for you on our menu for this Tuesday, August 13, 2024. We now leave you with Sultan Clinton and the song Juanita. Listening to Sultan Clinton and the song Juanita. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Carl Starling, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.